Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important battle spaces in that war, on our border, and what flows from it is a subject on which our first guest is deeply expert. Her name is Jessica Vaughn. She is the director of policy studies at an institution that I regard as indispensable in our understanding of all these issues, the Center for Immigration Studies. Jessica Vaughn, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Frank.
Well, there are two pieces of this issue that I wanted to quickly touch base with you on, Jessica, just to get an update from you. You follow this, as do your colleagues at CIS, very closely. How bad is the crisis at the southern border at the moment?
The crisis is worse than ever. The numbers released by Customs and Border Protection, the agency that includes the Border Patrol and also the legal ports of entry, show that in March, more than 100,000 people were apprehended by the Border Patrol and also tried to come through our legal ports of entry without documentation. This is the highest number in, I think it's about 12 years. And what is equally troubling is that more than half of these individuals are illegal migrants who arrived with kids because they know that U.S. policy is to allow them to be released into the United States to live wherever they want for an indefinite period. And so this is a crisis, not only a security crisis in terms of the number of people coming and the fact that the Border Patrol is overwhelmed, but it's a crisis for our communities too, where these individuals end up settling.
Yeah, so I want to come back to that.
The crisis is worse than ever.
Yeah. And just on this point about who is coming, the trouble is, as I understand it, the number 100,000 is assuredly the low end of what actually has been immigrating, the numbers of people that have been immigrating illegally to this country over the past month. If it's 100,000 that we know about, what multiplier do you use to try to capture what is getting through undetected?
Well, most experts, whether it's the Border Patrol or people who've tried to study this, believe that at least half that the number of people who have gotten away without detection by the Border Patrol is probably about the same number as the number who were caught. So in other words, they're only catching half the people who try.
Yeah. So on an annual basis, we're talking about 2 million people, conservatively, possibly, coming into this country illegally. And this raises the question that, of course, the president is seized with at the moment, and he's stirred people to new frenzies with his suggestion that the appropriate thing to do would be to vector at least some number of those that we're catching to so-called sanctuary cities and states in this country. And I heard your colleague Arthur last night on Breitbart Radio talking about one of the compelling reasons for that, which is these are places that are actually serving as magnets for this kind of illegal immigration, and that it's appropriate for them to bear at least a measure of the burden, not just, as the president said, for very overtaxed border communities. Your thoughts?
That's right. We know this from intelligence reports or interviews that the Border Patrol does with the migrants, that one of the questions they ask them is, where are you going? And if you look at that list, there's a lot of sanctuary jurisdictions on that list. And the reason is because these are places where politicians, openly gush about how welcome they are to immigrants and that they're not going to allow their police to cooperate with immigration enforcement and that they're going to offer publicly funded welfare benefits with no questions asked, and you know that they are going to bend over backwards to, in their words, welcome, but I would say attract and incentivize illegal settlement in those places, regardless of the impact on Americans and legal immigrants who live in these places. And that's why they head there.
So, Jessica, based on the analysis that you at the Center for Immigration Studies have been doing, is the president within his legal authority to do, at least with some of these people, what he's proposing in terms of sending them off to sanctuary cities and states?
Oh, there's no question that the president has the authority to do that. I would prefer that none of them be released into the country at all, because we don't want to encourage illegal immigration, and they're not going to qualify for asylum, so they should be sent back home. But I think the president has made a brilliant political point, which is that if these communities are going to have policies that encourage illegal immigration, they should be the ones to bear the brunt of the fiscal effects, the labor market distortions, and the other problems that are associated with illegal settlement, not the places in the country where that want to see the laws enforced. And these communities along the border are overwhelmed with trying to deal with this influx of people, and it's not fair that they should have to bear that on their own. Let's have some of the sanctuary jurisdictions take up this burden if they think it's such a benefit to their communities. I don't think that's going to happen. They seem to now be challenging the president and putting up a fight, but I think the president has made a brilliant political point. I would prefer not to see any taxpayer dollars on transporting illegal migrants anywhere into the country, but they're going to go to sanctuary jurisdictions anyway, as we've discussed, but it really is a brilliant political maneuver for these sanctuary supporters to have to explain themselves now. So,
Jessica, I hear people interviewed all the time who are mayors of El Paso or chiefs of police in some jurisdiction or other along the border, saying, "No, it's not really a crisis. We're managing fine. The president's overstating it. No, we don't need a border wall of some kind or barrier." What do we make of those kinds of comments, given what you've said?
Well, I think they're whistling past the graveyard to try to claim that there's no problem here, nothing to see here. I do think that they feel constrained by the politics within the Democratic Party at this point in time, where that party loyalty is more important to them than trying to solve this crisis. There are very few Democrats who are willing to admit what a crisis this is. And even if they do admit it, they say that it should be solved by more foreign aid to Central America or more drones at the border or some other non-solution. And that's really a problem that they are so animated by their hatred of President Trump that they can't get together to solve this problem for the good of our country.
Not least by making sure that the border is secure so that this flow is attenuated, if not stopped altogether. Jessica Vaughn, there's so much more to talk about, but we haven't the time to do it today. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we have one of my favorite reporters, brilliant investigative journalist at the Washington Times. His name is Rowan Scarborough. He is the author of the bestseller Rumsfeld's War, the untold story of America's anti-terrorist commander, among other things. He's also a very, very important chronicler of events that are critical to, well, the national interest as well as the national security. Notably, he has been all over the so-called Trump collusion saga, though from a very different perspective than that of most of the people who are reporting on that. Namely, he's just interested in the facts And as a result, he may not be a candidate for the Pulitzer Prizes that will be handed out. But he is certainly one who deserves them, that's for sure. Rowan Scarborough, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us.
Frank, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for your kind words.
Well, thank you for what you do, Rowan. And I wanted particularly to commend you for a piece that you wrote yesterday in the Times about the extraordinary access. We'll talk about lots of different parts of this peculiar story of the Mueller report, how it came to be, who was involved in it, and the rest. But just to set the stage, you had an insightful analysis of the extraordinary degree to which the FBI became certainly friendly to, but perhaps, you know, the plaything of Hillary Clinton's campaign in the 2016 election. Talk through that with us.
I think in U.S. political history, it's unprecedented, Frank, that the party in power's candidate, Hillary Clinton, and her operatives were given wide access to the Justice Department and the FBI in 2016 and 2017 to try to sell their various Trump-Russia conspiracy theories. They were able to have meetings with the FBI general counsel. They had the number four guy in the FBI, Bruce Ohr, as a messenger for them. They were able to meet with the deputy director of the FBI. All of their what turns out to be false charges were being fed to the Counterintelligence Center, which opened an investigation into the Trump campaign. And the FBI was more than willing to take this stuff and, in fact, got a wiretap on one piece of information that the Clintonites gave them. And I think this is why William Barr told Congress just recently that I'm reviewing this whole process and how the FBI opened this investigation, and stating something that we all know, that the Obama administration was spying on the Trump campaign.
I did want to get to the Barr statement. He is, of course, being now savaged for having said he believes that spying took place. He's also being roundly criticized for having captured in four pages what he believed were the highlights of the Mueller report. Give us a flavor of how important the Attorney General's statements and characterization of other statements have been in validating the reporting that you've been doing on all of this.
Well, I think Barr, in announcing that he's reviewing the process, is troubled by it. He would not commence a personal review of how the FBI started this investigation unless he's already been briefed on it and, you know, possibly read the media on it and is disturbed how the FBI gave all this access to opposition researchers, one of whom, Christopher Steele, was getting his stuff out of the Kremlin, for Pete's sake. I mean, they're using Kremlin information to try to sabotage the Trump campaign. I would think William Barr is very much disturbed about this. And for him to declare they were spying on the Trump campaign, of course they were. I mean, when you get wiretaps that allow you to reach into Texas emails, telephone calls, you're spying on that person. When you have a number of informants, FBI informants, ingratiating themselves to different Trump people in order to glean information, that's spying. That's just common sense, Frank. We all know that's spying. And if you look at headlines in the New York Times and other publications, what do they call FISA court warrants? They call them spy warrants, the spy court. What do we call satellites that listen in on people's phone calls? We call them spy satellites. So why the Democrats have taken umbrage at Barr using the precise words, it's just politics. But of course, he said it may have been predicated correctly. He said that also, and that's what he's trying to find out.
And I commend him for it. It's been courageous of him. It obviously has brought him the kind of personal ad hominem attacks that many of us have been treated to in recent years at the hands of the left and sometimes their Islamist friends. To the extent that we can say, and obviously we haven't seen the full report from Bob Mueller, we may never see the full report from Bob Mueller, though the Democrats in Congress are intent on acquiring it. But Rowan Scarborough, from what you know, from what you've done in your extraordinary reporting on this subject over the years, don't you think that if there were actually evidence of collusion on the part of President Trump or members of his campaign team or transition team or administration, that it would have come to light before now? And if it hasn't, that what Bob Mueller concluded, somewhat to my surprise, I have to say, but to his credit, and what the Attorney General has now said in characterizing what he found, sounds about right, don't it?
Exactly. Believe me, if Mueller and his team of Democratic Party donor prosecutors had found conspiracies, we would know it by now, number one. And number two, Mueller never would have put that sentence, bottom line sentence, in his report that I did not establish that there was a conspiracy or coordination, unless that is a fact that they did not. So, Barr is just conveying the exact words of Mueller, which has greatly, greatly depressed Democrats in town like Adam Schiff and Senator Warner of Virginia, who were counting on Mueller to give them the smoking gun so they could get President Trump. And he did not.
But having said that, to pause on that point for a moment, Rowan Scarborough, they may be depressed, but as best I can tell, they're not in any way, shape or form recanting their previous insistence that there was collusion, that there was evidence of the collusion, the evidence would be forthcoming, and all the rest. In fact, they seem to be doubling down, and yet there doesn't seem to be any forthcoming.
No, I mean, they are so intent on bringing Trump down that they're not going to abandon the Trump-Russia collusion. Just about every day, a Democrat will put out the talking point that Trump is a tool of Putin, things like that. They continue to say that, even in spite of the fact that Trump has been tough on Russia on a number of fronts. And, you know, what happened to Mr. Barr is the same thing that happened to Devin Nunes of the House Intelligence Committee. He had the nerve to veer away from Trump-Russia conspiracy and try to actually look at the conspiracy between the Democrats and the Kremlin to produce this dossier that had such a wide impact on the FBI and the town. And when he did that, he became public enemy number one of the Democrats and thus of the liberal media. And now that Barr has used the word spy and has said he's going to redact the report, things like that, he now is the number two target of Democrats in the liberal media because he's not playing along, you know, with the Trump-Russia conspiracy theories.
Right. Let me ask you, in all of this reporting, in all of this discussion, in all of this political posturing, and all of the hectoring, and all the rest of the efforts to take down Donald Trump, I have been absolutely flummoxed by the fact that the people who do most of that have chosen insistently to overlook the extent to which Hillary Clinton herself, or her campaign on her behalf for sure, colluded with the Russians. You've, again, been reporting handsomely on all of this for years now. Rowan, how is it that can be possible? How can they get away with that selective concern and the clear partisan character of it?
I think part of the answer, Frank, is that this dossier, that this Democratic finance dossier that was sourced strictly to Kremlin operatives, and then the information washed all over Washington, was done by Fusion GPS, which is in tight with the liberal press community in Washington. Fusion GPS works hand in glove with the New York Times and the Washington Post, and Christopher Steele, as it turns out, has contacts with the liberal media in town, and they don't want to turn, this is my opinion, they don't want to turn on the organization that has fed them stuff in recent years and will continue to feed them things.
Yeah, and as I understand it, some of them have actually been on their payroll. Is that right, that they've actually been getting money from these guys?
Nunes, when he got bank records for Fusion GPS, found that several reporters had gotten money, but he's never disclosed who they are. So to this day, we don't know who they are. But through court declarations in London, we know, and in a libel case in Florida, we know that Steele is in tight with Washington journalists. And he was able to spread his dossier around in two stages, before the election and after the election. And I think dealing with CNN, the Washington Post, BuzzFeed, you know, the power in this town, and they don't want to turn on the guy who was feeding them. And so even though the dossier is a hoax, in the word of Republicans, and likely disinformation from the Kremlin, the press doesn't want to turn on the guy. So they kind of ignore it.
It's outrageous. But even worse than the press, which may have all of those motivations, I find it just unspeakable that politicians are engaged in this practice too. They benefit, of course, from this for partisan purposes. They like the favorable press that they get as a result of perhaps the considerations you've talked about, Rowan Scarborough, but it's still shameful and terribly misleading, of course, to the American people. We have to leave it at that, my friend. Thank you for your time today. Rowan, I hope you won't be a stranger. Come back to us again soon. It's good to talk with you. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is with us, I'm pleased to say. He's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, and a great resource to all of us. The author of, among others, two important books, Apocalypse Unknown and Electric Armageddon. We're delighted to have him with us. Welcome, Peter Pry.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Let me just ask you, Peter, to talk us through something that you wrote about on the 12th of April in the Hill newspaper, which really caught my eye. And I think it warrants a lot of close scrutiny by every American. We have, for a very long time, Peter, taken for granted something you've spent most of your professional life trying to ensure is effective in deterring attacks against this country, namely the nuclear triad, as it's called, the three legs, land, air, and sea-based. You've actually argued for, well, what you might call a five-legged nuclear triad. I don't know what they'd call that, a pentad, perhaps, but talk about both why we need to augment what we've got and include some additional capabilities that aren't presently in the mix.
Sure. I call it what I'm calling for is a strategic pentagon. And this idea was inspired, actually, by Representative Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, who's been arguing for us to abandon the strategic triad and go to a strategic monad comprising only submarines, abandoning the ICBM and bomber legs of the triad, which would be an extremely dangerous thing to do. He also wants to cut in half the number of submarines we'd build. So instead of having 12 Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines, we will end up with just six and a one-legged triad. The whole idea between the triad deterred nuclear war all through the Cold War, and it continues to deter nuclear war and large-scale conventional war today. And the way it has done that is because by having three different legs, each of which have different unique characteristics that contribute to deterrence, but all of them together are greater than the sum of their parts, importantly because of their survivability. In the Cold War, it was difficult to engineer an attack against bombers, ICBMs, and ballistic missile submarines all together. The ballistic missile submarines were basically regarded as pretty much invulnerable, so that even if you could get the ICBMs and bombers, that last surviving leg of the triad, you know, would ensure you some residual retaliatory capability.
And thereby now, create costs to an enemy that would be unacceptable. And that's really the whole point. We don't want to fight a nuclear war, heavens knows, but we have to be sure, and more to the point, our enemies have to be sure that we can, if we need to. And Peter, that's been operating. So we're now having a leftist Democrat who has managed to rise through attrition to the ranks, through the ranks to the chairmanship of the House Armed Services Committee, now basically saying, oh, never mind, dispense with two of those legs and allow a minimal deterrent posture to be adopted, which frankly, according to Mark Schneider and Peter Husey and others of our guests, have raised real concerns about the vulnerability that would be associated with just having six submarine-launched ballistic missile platforms at any given time, probably only two of which would be at sea. And that is a formula for not minimal deterrence, but no deterrence at all. Don't you think?
Yes. This idea that Adam Smith has embraced is coming from the far left Greenpeace types, plowshares types, who basically have been anti-nuclear all through the Cold War and have they've realized their wildest dreams in Adam Smith.
Yeah. Unilateral disarmers is the way
exactly,
I think of it.
Exactly. So it's an extremely dangerous development. But part of my concern, and I say Adam Smith inspired my idea for the strategic Pentagon, was because it seems that many of my colleagues and friends who are reacting against Smith's proposition for the Monad have been investing, basically all of our argument has been on why the triad is tried and true and we got to keep the triad and we're defending the triad. And I definitely support that. We do have to keep the triad, but it's taken our eye off the ball of the evolving technological threat, because even if we keep the triad and do what the Trump administration is planning to do and modernize the three triad legs, which absolutely is necessary because they're going obsolete, we're still going to be in big trouble because the technological trends are against triad survivability, including ballistic missile submarines. There's a host of technologies that are actually already upon us, like hypersonic warheads, which will make possible their virtue is not, in addition to their incredible speed, they're almost invisible to radar. And their maneuverability also imparts to them unprecedented accuracy for ICBMs and long-range systems, so that you could really reduce the yields to extremely low levels. And we know the Russians have developed new kinds of nuclear weapons, pure fusion warheads, for example, that make no radioactive fallout at all. And indeed, the accuracies of hypersonic warheads, and even of their satellite-guided inertial guidance systems that rely on satellites and the like, will be so accurate that you could actually use non-nuclear conventional warheads to go after things like silos and bomber bases and ballistic missile submarines and ports. It might even be possible to do it with kinetic strikes that have no explosive power at all. And that would greatly reduce or eliminate collateral civilian casualties and basically make possible a clean nuclear war, which was the wildest dreams of the Soviet general staff during the Cold War, so that they could basically do a disarming first strike against which we would have no equivalent retaliatory
comparable response.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And be deterred from engaging in it because it would be so much more destructive. And Peter, what you've basically laid out here is so important, because what you're talking about could be possible in the hands of our enemies is actual. If it's not already in place, it is in the imminent future. And our deterrent capabilities, the maintenance or modernization of them most especially, is a thing of the future. Again, and that will depend on whether people like Adam Smith preclude it on Capitol Hill. No. But here's the point. Peter, I want to just pivot to one of your other most important alarms, and that is that in addition to the need to have two other kinds of deterrent capabilities brought to bear, we also need to address this problem of electromagnetic pulse. So very quickly, if you would, talk about the augmentation of our deterrent, as well as what we need to do about EMP.
Yes, the three legs of the triad are all offensive capabilities. My idea for a strategic Pentagon would entail turning active defenses like space-based missile defenses and passive defenses like EMP and cyber hardening into the two supplemental legs of the triad so that the triad can be made more survivable again by defending it from space and by defending it from EMP and cyber. EMP in particular is one of the threats to the submarines at sea. You know, the super EMP weapons that Russia, China, and probably North Korea have could destroy not only in our civilian critical infrastructures, but even our EMP-hardened military systems, because the hardening standards we used in the Cold War are no longer adequate against super EMP weapons. Submarines at sea are useless if they can't receive emergency action messages from the president and national command authorities, which are all vulnerable to EMP. So by severing the communications link, they basically would finally have arrived at the place where they could have neutralized the submarines. And the Russians aren't content with that alone. They're also deploying this new thing called the Poseidon with a 100-megaton warhead that's designed to trail our submarines, and it could be, you know, it'd have a lethal radius of over 100 kilometers, so they can have a kinetic kill as well as a system kill with the EMP. So the ballistic missile submarines are not survivable the way they used to be.
And that's even apart from what some have speculated may be coming, which is through the use of quantum computing and artificial intelligence and new sensors, a transparency of the oceans, which may make them even more vulnerable.
I didn't even get a chance to write about that in the article because you were limited to 850 words.
Yeah,
but
I hate
that. There's this new technology called LIDAR that National Geographic had an interesting documentary about it that can actually see through the forest canopies in Central America, and it has revolutionized our understanding of Mayan civilization, because we can now see, we only knew 10% of the cities that they built. Suddenly, because of LIDAR that can penetrate the jungle canopies, you know, we now know that the Mayan civilization was actually 90% bigger than it was. Now, if you can do something like that and penetrate jungle canopies and see through the Amazon, it's entirely conceivable that you can come up with, and the Russians have been working on this through the Cold War, to find some way to make the oceans transparent so they can see those submarines. They've been doing it with EORSAT and RORSAT satellites to listen to the submarine communications, trying to study the waves, but we should not be complacent. They might have already done it, and we just don't know about it. I mean, it's...
Could well be, given the lengths that they go to conceal from us capabilities that could be decisively used against us. Peter Pry, this is one of the reasons why we value so much the work you do at the Task Force on National Security and Homeland Security, as well as the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, as well as the cumulative work you've done over many years, both inside the government and in the press, to keep us apprised of the challenges of our time and help us meet them. Keep up the great work you do, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. In the meantime, safe travels.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and one of the country's preeminent authorities on the phenomenon of economic warfare. His name is Kevin Freeman. Kevin is the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman at Blaze TV. He is also available through other outlets, including economicwarroom.com and his two terrific books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, as well as the writing that he does at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin, it's always good to have you with us, but particularly in the aftermath of a address that the president made last week, in which he reiterated, to his credit, his commitment to ensuring that the United States has a secure national, that is to say, nationwide 5G network. And there's reason to believe that the vehicles that he's been encouraged to adopt to provide it won't do that. But I wanted, before we get into that, to talk about basically, as you see it, the importance from an economic warfare prevention point of view of the necessity of ensuring that this country, and for that matter, others in the free world, are not dependent upon companies like Huawei of China to provide 5G mobile connectivity.
Well, thanks, Frank. If anything, 5G is the infrastructure for Big Brother. I mean, we have a lot of oversight. We've got a lot of different ways that people watch and monitor and control us now. But 5G puts them in the next dimension. And frankly, it's to the president's credit that he recognizes that China has been developing and leading in 5G with the sole purpose of expanding the power of the Chinese government, the Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army. And they've been doing it through loans and involvement in infrastructure building in other nations around them. This is part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And they've been attempting to crack into the U.S. market. And President Trump has slapped down Huawei and ZTE a couple of times and said, no, this is our market. That's the good news. The bad news is that despite the fact that the president's paying attention to this, and he is, and that's good, the proposed solution seems to have come from the carriers, as opposed to open access wireless, where the government would allow the wireless and just about anybody could access it. This appears to be a carrier-dominated future, which opens us up to all sorts of nefarious problems, not the least of which is it may not work.
Well, it may ultimately not compete. That's the point. We may find ourselves buying by default a Chinese-supplied, you know, network that does work. And this is a grave concern, especially as we're seeing some of our allies do just that. Most recently, Germany has expressed an openness to having Huawei provide its 5G network. And Britain has already let them in for a piece of it, at least. And it's proven to be very difficult to extract themselves from it. Some have had second thoughts about it. And then, Kevin, I was just given a report from CNBC yesterday in which it was reported that Huawei is now offering to make its 5G chips available to Apple so that they can be put in their iPhones. Again, without getting into a lot of technical mumbo jumbo, Kevin, if Apple, an American-based company with global markets to be sure, but Apple winds up embedding these chips from a company with ties to the Chinese People's Liberation Army and government of China, the Communist Party, and so on more generally, would that not constitute a huge problem, even if we have networks that are, you know, more American-centric?
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge problem. And this is a part of Huawei's plan. Huawei has been on an apology tour. We don't do the bad things. We don't bow to the Chinese government. You know, there's nothing wrong with our chips. It's your intelligence agencies that have been politicized, and they have been. And that I blame a lot of this on the politicization of intelligence. So the Germans look at the reports and say, yeah, okay, and you said that Trump colluded with Russia too. And they dismiss a lot of the reports. But the intelligence community, the military community, is absolutely fervent in their belief that Huawei is a threat. And they have no other bias to look at that. They just simply are. And the idea that Huawei denies that they have any PLA involvement is just foolishness. There's no way that company. Now they're going into Apple and they're offering, supposedly, because there's a report that came out after that, subsequent to that, where Huawei says, no, we're not in discussions with Apple. But Apple is a business. They see themselves as a global business, not necessarily an American company. In fact, most large businesses do. Germany doesn't see. We've split up the world, and China is now trying to take advantage of it, whether it's corporately or whether it's geographically.
Yeah, this brings up a point that you make all the time in your economic war room program, Kevin, and I think can't be said often enough. When companies, whether they're Apple or whether they're Google or whether they're Microsoft, see themselves as global companies rather than American ones, it powerfully reinforces the bad sort of predilection of many of them for viewing the world as one big marketplace instead of a battle space. Could you just talk about this again, Kevin? We've discussed this in the past. You know, Google helping the People's Liberation Army with some of their artificial intelligence. You have the Microsoft China doing the same, apparently through Chinese military, you know, engaged universities. I mean, give us a flavor of how this actually works in practice if we are neglecting the battle space character of these regimes, operations, and the companies are at the forefront of doing that.
Well, for nearly 30 years, we've told American companies that the great opportunity comes in China, and then all of a sudden, the business leader who has to make quarterly profits sees a huge financial contract coming in from the Chinese, he's not going to evaluate to try and understand, well, what is this going to be used for? Because he assumes that China's just a new democratic capitalist state that's got some vestiges of communism. And that was the story we were told all the way through up to the Obama administration. And until President Trump, no one thought differently. And we were just continually thinking we're falling in line. So these companies and corporate executives have been bred on that basis to understand this is the big market, go after it. It's hard to turn down that big check when it comes in from China, knowing that it's going to make your bottom line look better.
Yeah, especially when it's evaluated by a lot of Wall Street analysts on a quarter-by-quarter basis. Hey, Kevin, lastly and quickly, there's a report in Asia Times that Southeast Asia is very vulnerable to cyber attack by North Korea. We've been talking a lot about the North Koreans' nuclear weapons program, but can you just fill in how dangerous what North Korea is capable of doing and the other kind of weapon of mass destruction, if you will, namely that in cyberspace?
Well, a few years ago when Sony Pictures was infiltrated and some, the report came out that it was North Korea, most people in the IT world laughed. They thought, oh, North Korea can't be that advanced. Well, this is the same North Korea that's been the world's largest counterfeiter for years, producing $100 bills that are almost impossible to distinguish from good money. And now they've gotten very active in cryptocurrency and attacking and stealing Bitcoin. They've also become very active in manipulating any criminal activity that they can on the cyberspace, because it doesn't matter where you are located, you could invade computers around the world, and the North Koreans are quite good at it. This is a threat, multiple vectors, one of which is that they're stealing things to finance their nuclear weapons program. Another is that they are now infiltrating and running mafia-like organizations with all sorts of tie-ins to blackmail and everything else in Asia, and they are now able to penetrate with world-class capabilities, major networks, and as the Chinese said in Unrestricted Warfare, a single computer hacker may be more dangerous than a nuclear weapon.
Kevin, thank you for putting the spotlight on what the North Koreans are up to in this particular domain, among others, as well as the body of work that you are not only preparing and producing at the moment, but that you've already provided us in the economic warfare space. We'll look forward to talking with you more about it next week. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you about those sorts of subjects and much more tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.